Hello, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today for another edition of Garden Talk. And I'm pleased to have Dick Zondag with us. He's the president of Jung Seed Company, Randolph, Wisconsin. Dick, it's a pleasure to have you here.
It's nice to be back, Jim.
Now that we are finally seeing some sunshine and temperatures above freezing, why things must be developing in the garden centers.
Yeah, things are starting to really move as far as seeds and getting the things ready in the greenhouse and things. And I think a lot of people are planting gardens this year because of the economy. Although gardening is a great hobby, it's a great thing to get out and be outside, and you get that good produce from it that when you go to the stores costs a lot of money. So, you know, a lot of people are getting into gardening this year. Our business is really booming because of that. But, you know, I guess what I would warn new gardeners is don't try to plant your backyard in a garden. Start in a smaller way and get used to the way things are, because gardening is a great lot of fun, but it's also some work because although you're planting these vegetables in there, the native weeds and maybe the grass that you just plowed under start to come back, and if it's too large, it becomes a real chore, and then you forget about doing it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, start with a small-sized garden and work up, and you'll be a gardener forever, because that produce that you take out of the garden is the best you'll ever have, because the quicker you can eat it, or the quicker you can preserve it after picking it, the more nutrition it has, the sweeter it will be. And you know, I get a lift out of it. I'm a gardener myself, and I get a lift out of picking things from my garden because it's something that I did. You planted that seed, or I planted that plant, and it grew, and it looks good, and you take it in the house, and you have it for supper or for lunch, and it really is good.
If you'd like to join us, the number here is 1-800-642-1234. Of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we'll take some calls and start with Sally. And Sally, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
It's good to hear your voice. I have always looked up to you for good information, and I believe that you and your company have true integrity.
Well, thank you.
Yes. I'm a grower now, and I'm trying to move to more organic fertilizers
for
my vegetables and my herbs. Not so much for the flowers. I'm not so concerned about organics for my flowers.
Right.
But for the herbs and the vegetables, yeah, I'm going to try to go more organic. But I want to know, this is what I want to know. I use Fafard 3B. It's a beautiful soil. I've tried lots of kinds of soil, but this is the one that I like it the best because it sticks easy, no weeds, tremendous growth. And I also and I'm going to keep using it because I just love it.
Yep.
I currently use an Osmocote 5 to 6 month slow release.
Okay.
And I love that also for my flowers.
Right.
But just because it's low maintenance, works well, great. Works good in containers. Now, this is what I need to know. I want to raise my container vegetables and herbs with organic fertilizer. Now, Dram fish emulsion is what I intend to use this year. The question is, will this fish emulsion work well with a sterile soil, or do I need nematodes or micronutrients like agloflash to break down the fish emulsion so it's available to plant?
No,
keeping in mind, 3B is basically dead. It's sterile.
Yes. I'm familiar with Fafard, and some of those products, they do put nutrients in. But if it's one that doesn't have nutrients, that fish emulsion will work really well because it's a combination of what they do is they take the guts of the fish, you know, any of the wastes that they have from the fisheries when they're cleaning the fish and things like that, and they put them in a compost pile and they ferment them, they compost them, and then they put them in a bottle. Now, I'd have to look at the bottle, but I think there is a little bit of nitrogen added to that. You'd have to read the bottle just to make sure, but I know that it's mostly organic. But I think they do fortify it a little bit with some nitrogen. But
it's OMRI certified.
Okay. Oh, it is. So then it is completely. No, then you don't need to have nematodes and things like that working. Most of the most of the nutrients that are in that would be readily available to the plant. And even though that favored peat-based soil is sterile, there are microorganisms working in there, and they would also help convert if it needs to be converted.
I think it does have a starter shot in it, too.
Right. So, you know, in fact, I try to be as organic as possible with my garden, too. I mean, a lot of the things that work with organic gardening, the composting, the planting varieties that are disease-resistant, and using a lot of the organic methods of gardening are great. I guess the one thing that I do, though, is if I have a problem with a disease or an insect that I know can be cured and it's getting to the point where it's damaging the crop, I guess I don't have an aversion to using some pesticides. But I try to be as organic as possible, because I think the idea behind organic gardening is a great application to make the use of pesticides and the use of chemical fertilizers a less necessary type thing.
Thank you, brother.
All right, Sally, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Dick Zondag, our guest on Garden Talk today. Let's go to Joanne next in Fitchburg. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I have a question for him. I usually shop from your store there and through catalog. I'm wondering whether you carry the thing called a tree lilac.
Yes, the tree lilacs will be in the Verona Road store probably in 2 or 3 weeks bare root.
Okay.
And that's really the most economical way of buying nursery stock. Then you're not paying for a pot and a ball of soil and the extra work that it takes to grow them in that container. And planting bare root is really, really easy, especially if you start as soon as the soil is ready to plant. And what I mean by that is as soon as the frost is out of the soil and the excess moisture has moved through so that you're not mudding plants in, the quicker you get your bare root plants in after that, the better off you are, because that way the roots have a chance to establish before the hot weather comes. And so I would say in another 2 to 3 weeks, it'll be time to get that bare root stuff in, and they have the tree lilacs. They will have them there.
Oh, you mean even before the before Easter? I should plant them even before Easter?
See, when is Easter this year? Easter. You know, Easter varies in time. I would say the last week in March, the first week in April is the time that you should start getting the bare root plants and getting them started.
Okay. And then can you tell me the difference, between the Japanese tree lilac and the
Canada Gem?
Other
sure.
tree lilac?
Yep. The Canada Gem tree lilac is a lavender-colored lilac. It has a probably much larger head to it. The Japanese tree lilac is sort of a creamy-colored blossom, and it's probably the last lilac that blooms. In fact, it sometimes blooms in mid to late May, which is very late for a lilac. So the Canada Gem is much earlier than that. It blooms with most of the other lilacs in early to mid, or mid to late April.
Which is more fragrant?
The Japanese tree lilac is more fragrant. The Canada tree lilac has very little fragrance to it.
Okay. And they can grow both in sun and shade?
Lilacs prefer sunlight. I would say if you've got less than a half a day's sunlight, they're probably not going to do well for you.
Oh, okay. So they should be in full sunlight.
Mm-hmm. Full sunlight to a half a day.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Joanne. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you today. An emailer from Brantwood is Bill, and he says the jack and the pulpits go wild in Zone 3 in Wisconsin, yet in the garden catalogs they're listed as Zone 5. What accounts for the difference?
The jack and the pulpits will vary a little bit in the hardiness depending on where they come from. You know, there are different races of jack in the pulpits. And when we do the catalog, we try to be a little on the conservative side.
I suppose, yeah.
You know, so I'm sure that there are populations of jack in the pulpit that will grow almost anywhere in Wisconsin. But you know, we like to be conservative. So, yeah, I would say the ones that we have in the catalog would probably work for him, too.
Speaking of catalogs, how many did you send out this year?
I didn't add up the whole amount, but I think about $7.5 million between the 8 different catalogs that we do.
That's got to be something to keep track of who's who and where they go.
Yeah, there's a lot of spreadsheets that we use when we're doing the catalogs. In fact, I just okayed the marketing plan this morning for the McClure and Zimmerman fall catalog going out, and the Jung one won't be about a week or 10 days before I'll be working on that one. So,
all right, let's go to Mark next in Wauwatosa. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Great.
All right. Hey, I have a question for you. We live in the city, and space is very tight. I rented from the community gardening program last year.
Okay.
That worked out pretty well, but, you know, it was an awful lot of work, what with thinning all the seeds and,
sure.
and just the weeding and all that. I'm interested in two different things for this year. I'm interested in, I don't know if you're familiar with square foot gardening.
Yes,
method.
I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the other thing I'm interested in is this container gardening.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And kind of taking the two ideas and putting them together. So just got to come up with some containers. I don't know if it'd be 5-gallon
sure.
buckets or, you know. But I wonder if I do that, you know, will the organisms in the soil, worms and such, you know, will they survive from year to year if I just leave the soil in?
No, they won't. And the square foot gardening and container gardening are somewhat similar because the square foot gardening, what they do is they build up raised beds in the garden. And then they plant it very, they concentrate them, you know. In other words, instead of planting a tomato every 18 to 20 inches like you would in a regular garden, they plant them probably 12 inches apart. And in a container, you just plant one. But what they have to do is they have to enrich the soil, use a lot of humus or peat moss, and in especially in the containers, because using a regular soil in a container, it gets very hard because that container is exposed on... Instead of just being exposed on the top, it's exposed all the way around. And so the temperature of the soil inside the container usually gets quite a bit higher, which tends to break down the organic matter, and it tends to change the dynamics of the soil. And so, like with hanging baskets, container gardening, and the square foot gardening, you want to use probably 30 to 50% of the soil as peat moss or compost or something that's organic so that, you know, it holds the nutrients, it holds the water. There's better aeration in the container or in that raised bed.
So if I had the space, I guess I go back and I rent again, maybe just kind of do a raised bed. And
yeah, what you do is take treated 4x4s or, you know, old railroad ties, a lot of people will use that, and then they just make squares of maybe 3 feet or 2 feet, and then they have paths between them, and then they plant their vegetables in there. Some people actually, instead of planting them in rows, they'll broadcast the seed over the whole area and then thin it down so that they, you know, instead of having a row of carrots, they'd have a block of carrots. So, and that's kind of the principle behind the square foot garden.
Are there any disadvantages to using landscape fabric instead of just doing a bunch of weeding?
Landscape fabric works well when you're planting crops like eggplant or tomatoes or peppers where it's one plant coming out of the ground, and that works really well. Black plastic or landscape fabric at holding the moisture in, it keeps the weeds from growing because it's black, and they may germinate underneath that fabric, but they won't push above it because the sunlight is blocked out, and any plant needs sunlight to grow. And so in areas where you're planting plants through. You can use the landscape fabric and then or black plastic, and then it keeps the weeding down. It works really well. That's one of the ways that you can keep the amount of weeding that you have to do down. But if you use black plastic, what you do is you weight it down on both sides. You cut an X in the plastic wherever you're going to put the plant, and then you put the plant through it, and then you pull the the plastic back around it. And a lot of people will put mulch over the plastic to kind of hold it down. If you do that, what you should also do is take a pitchfork and make sharp holes in the plastic so that water can go through it. If you're using landscape fabric, it's usually a woven type material where the water will go right through it.
Okay. All righty, then. Appreciate
All right.
it.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate Thanks. Hearing from you, Mark. And if you'd like to join in, there's a line open then at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest on Garden Talk today is Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company at Randolph, Wisconsin. More about their business at jungseed.com. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Garden Talk. Good to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. And again, we're talking about gardening with Dick Zondag, and we're going next to Sherry in La Crosse. Hello, Sherry.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to say that I really like Young Seed. I order out of the catalog, and I usually stop in the Stevens Point store on my way up north quite often. It's a great store.
Good.
My question is on the I purchased some Echinacea out of the catalog maybe like 3 years ago.
Okay.
Three plants.
Okay.
And they were the kind of a hybrid. They were kind of a light orange.
Okay.
I'm not sure if they were sundown or what they were, but
right.
I've had them growing like 3 years, and their petals don't uncurl.
Oh, boy.
And they just look pretty bad, and I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do to save them before I give up on them.
Are they in full sunlight?
Yes.
Okay. Your soil type is?
It's kind of a sandy, alkaline type soil.
And that's
perfect
for
right next to them, I have the purple coneflowers, and they're growing just fine.
Oh, boy. Usually, I mean, purple coneflower is the old standby, and the newer ones have been, I mean, Echinacea, the coneflowers have been inbred, crossbred, rebred, underbred, overbred. You know, and then they cross them back to each other, and then they get these unusual colors.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes the genetics are not as strong in some of these newer types, but the Sky Series, which it sounds like you have, has usually been pretty dependable. I guess what I would do is maybe add some organic matter, because coneflower is a native plant. It's,
uh-huh.
you know, it's not, I mean, not the colored ones. They're not native because they've been bred, but I'd work some organic matter into the soil, because if you've got a lighter, sandier soil, maybe that needs some organic matter. Maybe fertilize it with a well-balanced fertilizer like Fertilome's Rooting and Blooming, or something where the second and third numbers are a little higher than the first numbers. Although if it's not growing well, maybe you need a little nitrogen too, because sandy soils tend not to have a lot of nitrogen. But having a regular coneflower growing good next to it really... Boy, that's really a tough one. But that's what I would do. I'd add organic matter to the soil. I would fertilize it. Maybe use a little bit of sulfur around it, or iron sulfate, to acidify the soil if it's a little on the alkaline side, because most prairies are neutral to a little bit acidic.
Uh-huh.
But, boy, other than that, I really don't know what to tell you. But that's what I would do. I would just put organic matter in the soil, and then use some iron sulfate to acidify the soil, and then fertilize them a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well,
All
thank
right.
you very much.
Good luck to you, Sherry. Thanks very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And again, if you'd like to join in, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Had an emailer from Madison inquire about growing lentils in the Madison area. Can she do that?
Yes, lentils, because you're just because it's an annual, you know, and it's a legume. You know, be sure you use the inoculant on it. There should be no trouble. I mean, I think we have a long enough season to grow lentils, so I would plant them.
Do you sell them in the catalog?
Yeah, no, we don't, and I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a legume. I'd plant them out as soon as the soil is warm. I mean, I wouldn't plant them out until probably late April, early May, and then they should germinate right away. And I would think that you'd have pretty good luck with them.
Okay. And on we go to another caller, is Steve in Green Bay. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. I guess I might be kind of naive here, but I would like to ask a couple questions about the mini corn.
Okay. You're talking about the little ears?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, are these full-size plants or...
No, the plants themselves are a little smaller, too, but they get multiple ears on them. The variety that we handle, and that's one of the things that I used to have a problem with, too. I didn't know exactly how to grow them. But you've got to use a variety that's meant for these mini ears, and the variety that we have is called Bonus.
Bonus.
B-O-N-U-S. Okay. And you plant it just like regular corn, but you harvest the corn, you know, the corn ears when they're very small.
Okay, do the plants grow as large as regular corn? Or?
No, they don't. They're about probably a half to two-thirds the size. But like I said, they get multiple ears on them. And then you just have to pick them when they're prenatal, you know, when they're very small.
Okay, now that's before they turn yellow and do they...
Yeah, because they're you know, when you get them in Oriental salads or in...
Exactly.
Cooking and stuff like that, they're very small, and what I think what you do is you just let them till the, you know, till the silks come out, until the silks dry, and then you harvest them.
Okay. Do you need to plant those in I've grown sweet corn before.
You just plant them just like regular sweet corn. You maybe want maybe crowd them a little bit more than you would with regular sweet corn, but then you just pick them when I'd have to go back and look, but I think when the silks dry off, that's when you pick them. You know, where regular sweet corn, it's probably 2 weeks after the silks dry off, that 2 to 3 weeks, and then you pick the sweet corn.
Okay, so you don't wait until they turn yellow or
anything like that? No, you don't.
Okay, and you don't have to do any cross-pollination with those? Or?
No. Nope, you don't.
Okay, you've answered my question.
Okay, Steve.
Yep, thanks for calling.
I didn't know if they could even be grown around here.
It's not a crop that's grown real regularly around, and it was one of the things a few years back that I really wouldn't have had that answer for you, but we found this variety called Bonus, and that's the one that's used for the small ears, the little ears that you get in Oriental cooking.
Steve, thank you so much. We appreciate your call, and let's go next to Martin in Madison. Hello, Martin.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a garden. I grow in a community-sponsored garden plot area.
Okay.
And I've had problems with flea beetles eating up all the foliage on, like, radish plants and Colorado potato beetles pretty much decimating my eggplants.
Okay.
I'm wondering now if row covers would alleviate this problem, either polyester or cloth row covers.
Yes, they would, because it would keep the beetles from getting underneath. Well, you'd have to put it over the plant and then seal them all the way around, because they won't go through that mesh. But row covers is a good way, an organic way of keeping the beetles away from your plants. With potatoes, though, there's also BT. There's a Colorado potato beetle, Bacillus thuringiensis, that you can use to kill the Colorado potato beetle, which is organic. It's a bacterium that you use.
Okay, then. So I could spray that right on the eggplant then?
Yep, you could spray it on the eggplant. It's a bacteria that they ingest, and it takes them out.
Do I have to consider the flowering time when I'm applying the BT?
No, because it's completely unharmful to anything but beetles, but the potato beetles.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for
all
calling.
Right, thank you very much for your call. We had an emailer from Greene County, and Dave wonders, we need to kill a healthy 9-year-old stand of brome grass growing on our septic tank field and replace it with a long grass, maybe a carefree grass.
Mm-hmm.
What are your suggestions there?
Well, first, to kill the brome grass, you just use Roundup. I mean, that's very simple because Roundup is a non-selective herbicide. Anything that's green that it touches, or I'd say most plants that are green that it touches, it will take out. So that's the way you get rid of that grass. And then I would use probably just a, if it's in the sun, I would just use a bluegrass, you know, just a regular lawn grass. And if it's in sort of a, well, you wouldn't want it in a shady area because the tree would get into the drainage field. So I'd just use a regular bluegrass mix of some sort or another that you don't have to use the real high-quality stuff if it's just for a drainage field, but just anything with bluegrass that has a little bit of annual rye in it that acts as the nurse crop. And that you want to get on as soon as the soil is thawed out and the frost is gone and the excess moisture is through, because grass will germinate in cool soil. And grass grows mainly in the spring and the fall in the cool weather. So the quicker you get the seed on and growing, the better off you are.
Yeah.
Yep. You just spread the seed, kind of rake it in, and then put maybe an inch of hay or straw over it to keep it from drying out.
Talk@WPR.org is our email address in case you have an interest in sending that. Otherwise, let's go to Mike in Waterford next. Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. My question is some ever-bearing strawberries that I planted.
Okay.
This will be going into the third year.
Okay.
Last summer, very good production, but there would always seem to be a beetle of some type out of the ground that would just eat up the berries right as they ripen.
They're called picnic beetles.
Yeah, that's what they look like.
And I'm not sure if dormant spray works on strawberries. Dormant spray would be the thing that I would use, but the picnic beetles overwinter in the mulch or in the dead leaves around the base of the plant. And then the reason that picnic beetles are so plentiful around strawberries when they start to ripen is they like sugar. They know that when there's sugar there. So there are pesticides that you can spray with, just a regular fruit tree spray. You got to follow the directions as far as reentry. So you want to control them probably 2 weeks before you start picking the berries. Minimize the amount of overwintering habitat that you have. In other words, in the fall, after the plants go dormant, after they've been frosted and they're not going to grow anymore, probably in mid-November, set your mower as high as it will go and then take all of the weeds and the stuff that's there. Now, the problem is you really like to mulch strawberries for the winter so that they don't start growing when we get our typical winter thaw, and it's also good for holding them back so that they don't get nipped by the frost. But when you remove the mulch, I guess I would remove it completely rather than leaving some of it there for weed control and for keeping the moisture in until the picnic beetle problem is gone. But just a regular fruit tree spray, most picnic beetles will be taken out by almost any of the general pesticides like malathion or 7 or those types of things.
Okay, so if I spray these, I wouldn't necessarily have to spray the plant as much as the ground around them?
What you have to do is follow the directions on the package. It will tell you, where to direct the spray. The problem with picnic beetles is they hang around wherever there's organic matter. You know, the eggs will be laid, and then they hatch from that. So you almost have to spray around the plants. And if you want to keep the spray off the plants, that's probably okay, but you're not going to control them as well as if you do just a general spray. But the label will tell you what the reentry time is. So it'll say, we do not spray within 2 weeks of harvest or within 10 days of harvest. So you have to be careful and read the directions.
Okay. And you said 7 works good for this, huh?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And as far as some type of fertilizer to put on these?
Just a regular, well-balanced fertilizer, something that doesn't have too much nitrogen in it. The three numbers are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and so you want to pick something that has some nitrogen in it because that creates the plant growth. But if you use too much nitrogen, you get all leaves, and the flowers and fruit are much smaller. So you don't want to overstimulate them, so just a good, well-balanced garden fertilizer. The bag will say garden fertilizer. It'll have an analysis of 5-10-5 or 5-10-10, or there are some that are 8-8-8, so... As long as it says garden fertilizer on the bag, it works really well. Or if you want to use a liquid fertilizer, the rooting and blooming, the Fertilome's rooting and blooming, or the fish emulsion fertilizer works really well in that type of a situation too.
Okay, very good. Thank you for your help.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for your call. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234. As we talk with Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, 102 years in business.
Yes. I haven't been there all 102 years, though.
It just feels like it some days.
Days it does, yes.
And, of course, you can find out what they have at jungseed.com. And let's talk about soil tests, since soil is the foundation of anybody's gardening success. A soil test will find out what your soil has and needs, and it's done relatively quickly, isn't it?
Yes. A soil test, basically what you do is you take any kind of piece of pipe or a rod of some sort or another, and maybe a half a dozen different spots in your garden. You take a core of soil about 6 inches deep, because that's basically how deep the roots of the plant go, and you put it in a paper bag and you take it to the county extension office. They will send it into the state testing lab and they'll send you the results of it, and it will tell you what the pH of the soil is, because most plants grow at neutral or slightly acidic or slightly basic. And it will also tell you the level of the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and it will tell you what kind of fertilizers you have to use. And then if you use, we're talking about the organic way of gardening. If mm-hmm. you do the composting and you get that compost in good shape and add it to the soil, if you use a little bit of fertilizer when you plant the garden, for onions, you got to use a little bit more. That's about the only vegetable that I fertilize after I plant it. But the way that I, and once you get your garden in good shape, the only time you really have to repeat a soil test is if the plants start to look yellow or something doesn't look right. That's the first thing that you really want to make sure, is that your soil is well balanced, that the nutrients are in good level, because most gardens do well at adequate nutrient levels. You don't want them to have them too high or too low. And most vegetables don't require a lot of fertilization. Now, there are some that you'd like to feed, like rhubarb is one that is a heavy feeder, mm-hmm. and it grows quite rapidly, and so you have to divide it every 3 or 4 years. And onions, because they have such a small root system, I just put a line of fertilizer along the row maybe a couple times during the summer, because the root system is so limited. But other than that, I mean, if you use the inoculant on the beans so that you get the nitrogen fixing, then that fixes the nitrogen. And when you work your garden up, it turns those nodules into organic nitrogen. And you're adding the compost. If the compost is well done, and you've and I do add some fertilizer to the compost bin, because that makes the microorganisms work well. And then you add that to your garden, and you do that every year. You'll have the most beautiful garden soil in the world.
Yeah.
Yep.
And if you've got enough sunshine, you can grow something.
Exactly.
Let's go to Pete next. And Pete, what's on your mind?
Good morning, gentlemen. I have recently ordered some pear trees from Jung Seed Catalog, and I was just looking for some tips on raising those pear trees.
Okay. Pears are trees that you have to get the shape of the tree into it when it's young, because pears do not like to be pruned heavily after they're, 5, 6, 7 years old, because they throw out water sprouts, and the water sprouts are very susceptible to fire blight. That's one of the diseases that's deadly to a tree. It will kill the tree. So when you plant the pears tend to be very upright in nature, and so you want to get a good structure. You want to start, especially if you're planting them in a yard, you know, many of the guides tell you to start the lower branches 3 to 4 feet off the ground, but problem with doing that in a yard is that if you start them that low, it's hard to mow underneath them. And so when they get larger, you'll throw the mower towards the trunk so that you don't have to bend over to get underneath it, and you'll hit the bark, and more, you know, shade and fruit trees are killed from a lawnmower than from almost anything else. So I would start the first branches probably 4 to 5 feet off the ground, and then just get that open structure. Cut the leader of the tree out so that you get side branching, and then maybe get the branching structure in sort of a world pattern, so that you're not having branches coming out right on top of each other. And then, you know, just keep the tree real open. My dad used to tell people in the garden center, if you can throw a cap through the tree in the wintertime when there are no leaves, your tree is pruned perfectly.
All right. How about proximity to other trees? Is there anything that they don't like to be near? Or?
No. The only thing you don't want to do is plant them real close to other trees. I mean, most fruit trees, you like to have 20 to 30 feet between them, because they do grow bigger as they get older. Although pear trees can probably be put a little closer together because their natural habit is more upright than say apple trees. But you know, I would say 25 feet apart is a good spacing, and as much sunlight as they can have. Pears are somewhat self-fruitful, so you don't really need two different varieties, but you'll get more pears if you have two different varieties.
Oh, I see.
And what varieties did you order?
I believe they're Bartlett. I didn't actually. My wife placed the order, I believe.
Okay, well, one of the problems with Bartlett is that it does start to rot from the inside out if you let the tree, the fruit mature on the tree. So when the fruit starts going from green to sort of a light yellow color, pick the fruit. And if you let them ripen on the tree and mature on the tree so that they start falling off, what you'll find when you open them up is that the core is starting to rot. And it's not anything that you can do about it. It's a genetic problem with Bartlett, and I really have no idea why that got to be such a popular variety, but that's one of the problems with Bartlett. If you let it mature on the tree, it starts to rot from the inside out. So pick them on a little bit on the green side, and then they'll store for a while, or you can can them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're good pears.
About how what age do the trees mature to fruit?
If you get fruit on pear trees the first 2 years, you should pick them off, because you want the strength of the those first 2 years to go into the tree, to establishing the root system to get the tree growing. Pears, you really don't have a lot of problems with it growing and maturing. If you don't have fruit in 4 or 5 years, call back or drop me a line. I'll tell you how to do it. But pears tend to mature earlier than apples, and so especially if you're getting a dwarf varieties, you may have fruit on them the first year or two. You don't want to have that. You want the because the tree will naturally throw everything it has into its reproductive organs, and it will take things that should be used for establishing a tree and putting it into the seed. So
Take it right at the blossom then?
No, they'll blossom and they just don't set the fruit. So I would say, in mid-July, if you have fruit on them the first 2 or 3 years, get in there and pick it off.
All right.
If it's before that, it may drop off naturally because it's not cross-pollinated. But if you get fruit on it the first year or two, I would take them off. And the third year, not a heavy crop, and then after that, just let them go.
Mm-hmm. Any specific kind of fertilizer they need?
We sell some fertilizer tablets, or, you know, when you're planting the tree, you should soak the roots for 24 hours in water. We sell a product called Root Stimulator that you can put in the water that's a nutrient-based product. And if you don't have any of the tablets, just work a little bit of garden fertilizer into the into the soil that you put around them. The nice thing about the tablets is that they're a slow-release thing, and they'll last 4 to 5 years, so you don't have to worry about fertilizing them for that first few years. If you don't, the fruit trees don't need to be excessively fertilized, but depending on your soil type, a little bit of fertilizer dropped around the drip line of the tree every 3 or 4 years is good.
Pete, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you on this edition of Garden Talk. Dick Zondag is our guest. He's the president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard on for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network on Garden Talk. Glad to have you with us today as we talk with Dick Zondag, the president of the Jung Seed Company. Sarah Carroll is our on-air producer. And I would like to mention an event coming up in the Green Bay area. That'll be the Spring Thaw Symposium, sponsored by the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And that'll be Saturday, April 4th, between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. at the Holiday Inn City Center in Green Bay. Featuring Scott Ogden and Lauren Springer Ogden. Their latest book is called Plant-Driven Design, Creating Gardens That Honor Plants, Place, and Spirit. Roy Diblick, who is co-owner of Northwind Perennial Farm, which is located in Burlington, Wisconsin, and Brent Gustafson, who is with Midwest Ground Covers, LLC, the what, the why, and the care. All of them taking part in the Spring Thaw Symposium April 4th, sponsored by the Green Bay Botanical Garden. You can get more information by going online at gbbg.org, or you can give them a call at 877-355-4224. But let's continue to talk with Dick Zondag, and the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And let's go next to Jeff in Stockbridge. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. First of all, I want to thank you for the information on the pear trees. We just put one in last year and plan on putting another one in next year. Okay. So that was interesting to know. I found a lot of information there. My question is about gooseberries. Okay. We planted three gooseberry plants, two Invicta and one Tixia,
okay,
2 years ago, and one of them took off right away, and it's actually growing real good right now. The other two didn't make it for some reason, which I don't know why. Last year I ordered another one, a Tixia, and planted that, and it's still, that one didn't take also. I don't know, and I'm trying to figure out why they're not growing. I got the little pamphlet from Jung, you know, how to prepare the soil, and I did that, added the peat moss and compost and manure and sand and stuff to make the soil drainable.
Okay.
And for some reason, like I said, I got one that's growing good, and I got three of them that didn't make it, and I got another one actually on order right now.
Okay,
I refuse to give up.
Did you soak the roots for 24 hours before you planted them?
Yes, I did. I went right by the
okay, because that,
in the book.
Boy, of all the things that that are important in planting bare root, it's to get as much moisture into that root system as possible without injuring it before you plant it. Because with bare root nursery stock, it takes about 10 days, a week to 10 days for that root to become active and start taking up water on its own. And that's why it's also important to plant the things before the hot weather hits, because that way the plant has a chance to establish the root system before the hot weather comes and there's a lot of demand on it. Gooseberries are, boy, you know, I've always thought that they're relatively easy to plant.
That's what I thought, too.
Try putting a little bit of soluble plant food in the water.
Okay.
You know, we have a product we call Root Stimulator that we sell, but, a little bit of, not at the strength that the bottle says, because that's for applying to the soil. Probably about a half or a third of what a soluble plant food would say maybe would help. I mean, it isn't going to make the difference between growing and not growing. Scratch the bark of the plant when you get it, and make sure that there's green underneath, because that means that the plant's alive.
Actually, the one that I got last year was actually almost looked like it was almost starting to bloom already. It had the little green tendrils coming over the branches already, and you know, and once I stuck it in the ground, then they kind of died off and it never came back again.
If that happens again, prune it back to within maybe 6 to 8 inches from the ground so that you reduce the amount of stress that there is on the plant, because if there's those leaves start to form before the roots are established, it could dehydrate the plant. So maybe take those off.
Okay.
We try not to send them out. Sometimes they're in the mail a little bit long when they're, and then that would cause them to start growing.
Yeah, it was just barely starting to bud last year. Yeah. Now, the first ones I bought, we bought right from the store in Randolph, and then brought them home and soaked them for a while and then planted them, you know.
Well, and it's just 24 hours that you want to soak them.
Yeah, that's what I meant for for the day.
Yeah, if you soak them much longer than that, then because the water takes them out of the air, and the roots do need air as well as the tops, they need to breathe. So 24 hours is probably the optimum amount of time that you want to soak a bare root plant before you plant it. So
and then maybe like a 1/3. Mixture of the soluble fertilizer put in a hole.
So if it says use a teaspoon per gallon, use maybe 1/3 of a teaspoon a little less than that. Just enough so that some of the nutrients get into the root system.
All right.
But like I said, it shouldn't make a difference. Now, if you do have plants that don't grow, you know, they are guaranteed.
Yeah.
Did you report them?
That's where I got the one from last year.
Oh, okay. And it didn't grow either. Okay. So, once is all we do that, though.
I know. That's what I mean. Okay. That's going back to square one. But I bought another one. It should be coming again, you know, like in May whenever you guys send them out. And I'll have to start over again. But.
Okay.
Well, good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Jeff, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Marion is next in Windsor. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I have a few questions, actually. One is about neem oil, and I don't know if you had mentioned anything about that previous to my listening for the Japanese beetles. Does that work?
Yes, it does. Neem is another one of the organic pesticides that's an extract of a plant, and that would, I mean, that's also a good insecticide to use on most anything. I mean, that's not a selective type thing. It will kill most any insects that are there.
Okay, do you know how often you have to spray that on something? Pole beans and raspberries is what I really have.
Yeah, I don't have a bottle right in front of me. I would suspect that it's a weekly treatment, but again, the label will tell you exactly how much to use and how often to use it, and then how many times to use it. Because, see, what happens with insects is there's an egg, a larvae, and an adult stage in most life cycles of the insect. And neem, I think, will be very effective against the adults. But then you also have the larvae and the eggs that are coming. And so you want to spray over a week to 10 days period. But like I said, the label of the pesticide will tell you, you know, how much to use, how often to use it, and then how far apart, you know, how many days between treatments. And it there's a lot of research that goes on, and there are a lot of pesticides, and my hard disk is almost full, so I have a hard time remembering all this stuff.
I understand. and then another question is about rabbit manure. I have a good source of that from somebody that keeps rabbits and for show and that kind of thing.
Okay.
I've been putting that on in the fall. It's very easy to spread. It's wonderful stuff. It's
great.
Easiest manure I've ever handled. And I've just been sprinkling it on just about everything. Is that a good fertilizer to use?
It is, but, fresh manure tends to put a lot more nitrogen in the ground than you need. And sometimes with things like tomatoes and some of your root crops, if you get too much nitrogen in the soil, you'll get all tops, you get a lot of growth, but the vegetables will be smaller, the tomatoes will be inhibited from blossoming. I guess when I use fresh manure, I like to run it through the compost bin. You know, use it in the fall as a nitrogen or a fertilizer source to decompose the leaves and the organic matter, and then add it, and then you surely won't have too much nitrogen. And that goes with the cow manure and things like that, too. If people are using manures, you probably shouldn't be using fresh manure. You should be using the stuff that's been sitting in the yard for a year or two. And that way, you're not over, overdosing the garden with nitrogen.
Okay, and I have a lot of rhubarb, and that is one of the
it's excellent for rhubarb because
that, regularly on that, not as much in the vegetable garden.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And then one more question about carrots. I have not had very good carrots, and I've been trying to keep from walking on the area so that the soil doesn't get compacted. But I think there's maybe some lacking of some nutrients too. And what kind of nutrients do carrots like a lot of?
Well, actually, they are just like most vegetables. They're not real heavy feeders. They like to have an adequate amount of nutrients, but not an over amount of any one of them. What type of soil do you have?
It's fairly sandy.
Okay, well, then that isn't the problem, because some of the heavier soils have problems with carrots penetrating. I guess what I would do is maybe use a little bit more of the rabbit manure around them.
Okay.
Do they have really big tops on them?
No, they don't.
Okay. Well, then that's the other thing. If they have really big tops and you're not getting much underneath, that's a sign that there's too much nitrogen there. But if they're not, really bushy tops, then
overloaded.
Okay. Then what I would do is maybe use a little bit more nitrogen. And the other thing, the sandier soils tend not to hold nutrients as well as the black soils, which I'm blessed with in Randolph. In my garden, I have a really nice deep silt loam, which really is excellent for gardening. If you have a sandy soil, be sure you're adding organic matter. Compost your leaves and, use the rabbit manure in that and then add that to the soil. That will really make the texture and the organic matter in your soil much better.
Dick Zondag is our guest today on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us today for Garden Talk. Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company at Randolph, is our guest. And, Dick, it's a pleasure to have you here at the microphone.
It's great to be back, Jim. I do this quite often, but it just seems like the time flies when we're sitting here talking to people. And I can't think of anything that I'd rather do with talk gardening because back home, I don't get to do it a whole lot, so it's a great thing to get out and hear what people are thinking and what problems there are out there, and it's really nice, so I enjoy doing it.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 800-642-1234, and of course, we're accepting emails at talk@wpr.org. We had some earlier conversation about the use of BT with beetles, and a listener wondered which BT is recommended for the potato beetle. Do you know off the top of your head?
There's a product called Colorado Potato Beetle Beater in our catalog that's specifically for the Colorado potato beetle, which is the insect that defoliates the potatoes. It's kind of funny because a few years ago we had a potato that had that BT gene in genetically modified into the potato, and we got pictures of from some customers that had planted both of them side by side. And I have one picture I remember. They had three rows of potatoes that were the new leaf potatoes with that BT gene in it, and three rows of ordinary potatoes. And the three rows of potatoes that were ordinary were skeletons. There wasn't a leaf on them.
Oh.
And the others were just as green as grass, sitting right next to each other. But this product is very, very effective against the Colorado potato beetle. And, you put a little bit of detergent in it so that the water spreads evenly over the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And it does a very nice job of taking care of the Colorado potato beetle.
Let's go back to the phones, take some calls. We'll go to Sue in Portage next. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Here in Portage, we heard you earlier talking about the increased interest in gardening, and I wanted to let people know that in Portage on April 18th at the Park and Rec building, 806 Silver Lake Drive, we're going to be offering a field day, especially for beginning gardeners. It'll include things like vegetable gardening basics, herb gardening, container gardening, compost and mulch, and also some information on rain barrels. And it's free. We would appreciate if people would call in to the county extension at 742-9680 so we can have enough handouts, and there'll be lots of hand-on activities. So
that's really good. You know, getting people out there and teaching them a little bit about gardening will do nothing but help them later on. I mean, it's a great hobby. To get outside and to work in the soil, and it really is nice. So,
and Sue, again, what date is that?
It's on April 18th.
April 18th.
From 1 to about 3:30, and it's put on by Columbia County Master Gardeners as well as Sustain Columbia. Here.
And you mentioned that number 608-742 and the last four.
It's 9680.
9680.
We're hoping for a great turnout.
742-9680. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing
thanks.
From you. And let's move next to Dick in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
I started some cucumbers with seed, and they got about 2.5-3 inches tall. They were looking real good. And they've just, for the last week, they've just been in the same place. They haven't moved. They haven't done anything.
Most vine crops have to be transplanted in the container that you start them in. And so I'm almost thinking that those plants are going to be too large when you plant them out. We usually recommend starting the vine crops in a peat pot about 4, maybe 5 weeks before you're going to plant them out. And so you may be planting out a week or two earlier than we do. But in the garden centers, we recommend about May 1 that you start your vine crops because they don't do very well in the cold weather. Vine crops like to have a warm soil and warm weather before they start to grow. What I think is probably happening is the roots are starting to penetrate outside of the pot. And once you start pruning those roots or they start filling the pot with roots, they start to slow down.
Well, they don't show any roots coming out at all.
They don't.
And I've got them on a heater.
Okay.
Maybe it's not getting enough sun. I don't know.
Well, yes, and maybe you want to use a very dilute solution of a plant food, too, because what kind of soil did you start them in?
Well, it's some starter soil that I had last year that I used.
Okay.
And I baked it this year, cooked it, and then I sterilized the containers.
Okay.
Started it in that.
But maybe what you want to do is use a little bit of fertilizer, a soluble plant food at about a third to a half strength. Because you don't want to push them too much when they're indoors and it's this early yet. But that would, that would speed them up. But maybe you're better off not having them grow right now because I'm afraid they're going to be quite large by the time you plant them out.
I had a couple of them that got started up and now they're just dying off.
Now, the other thing, too, is don't overwater them. Most plant root diseases are started because the soil is kept wet too long. And I think probably more plants are killed by overwatering than by underwatering. Be sure you feel the soil. If it feels moist, don't water it. When it gets dry, then you want to water it heavy so that water comes out the bottom of the pot, and then let them dry out between waterings. You may be getting, I mean, are you watering them on a regular schedule, or are you watering
about
them?
About every 3 days or something.
Yeah.
Unless it's real cold out and humidity drops in the house someday.
Yeah, but feel the soil with your finger. If it feels moist, don't water them, because that might be inhibiting their growth, too, by watering them too much. Okay?
But what's the fertilizer composition?
The analysis, you mean?
Yeah.
I would just get a regular, if you can find Fertilome's Rooting and Blooming or just a regular Balanced, I mean, the soluble plant foods are all over the place with the analysis. Some are 10, 52, 48, and you get a lot more nutrients in a soluble plant food than you do in a bag because they're all salts and there's no filler in them. And so, one I wouldn't use is one that has a lot on the first number. A rapid grow is one that I would think of that you only use when you're out in the garden. But most plant foods like Hyponex or Fertilome, if it's a soluble plant food, use it at about a third of recommended rate, and that would give them a little bit of nutrients.
Miracle-Gro, I've got that.
Okay, Miracle-Gro I would use probably at a quarter. Miracle-Gro, I think, has a lot of nitrogen in it.
Dick, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Charlotte is next in McConnell, Illinois. Hi, Charlotte.
Oh, okay. Hi there. Excuse me. I have a question comparing at least three of your company's catalogs.
Okay.
Zurn Zimmerman, Jung's, Shumway's.
Okay.
Okay, now some of the items are the very same things in the different catalogs,
right,
and they even have the same order numbers, but the prices are different.
Okay.
And you have different priced postage. Like Shumway's is a dollar cheaper than the Jung's.
Right.
And the Canna's and the McClure and Zimmerman are much higher for the exact same Canna is what's in the Jung's catalog.
Well,
plus, the postage is a lot higher.
Well, McClure and Zimmerman is a bulb specialty catalog,
mm-hmm,
and I can't. It seems to me, although I can't be positive, that the McClure and Zimmerman we order, or we have larger divisions in, on some of the products than we do.
The Canna's, it says 2 to 5 I tubers,
okay,
just like the Jung's. That's
okay,
what I was wondering.
But they may be a little bit larger. You know, I don't, and sometimes it has to do with the marketing, the price of the catalog.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of things that go into pricing other than the cost of the product that you're, you know, that we buy.
And in the Shumway's, the Dropmore Scarlet Honeysuckle Vine is a dollar cheaper in the Shumway's, and Shumway's postage is a dollar cheaper than the Jung's catalog. And it has the exact same order number in both.
Well, that
catalogs.
One I know you get the exact same plant, so I'd buy it from Shumway.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered.
It has to do with marketing. You know, we do a lot of tests, and the shipping and handling thing is also a big marketing thing. Some of them we base it on a percentage of the order. Some of it's based on a range of size. Each catalog is done a little bit different, and there's a lot of marketing that goes into that. And so it's just, how do you explain it? It's marketing. Some of the costs, if you look at the Shumway catalog versus the Jung catalog is printed on shiny paper in full color, the Jung catalog is shiny paper, full color throughout. The Shumway catalog is newsprint with black and white throughout. And so there's a huge difference in the cost of printing that catalog, and that has to be paid for somehow. And, you know, sometimes you get a cheaper price in Shumway because it's less expensive to, you know. And so it's all marketing. Some of it has to do with just, you know, what will the customers pay? So, but with McClure and Zimmerman, that's a more upscale catalog. And so, for instance, in the fall bulbs will be a little more expensive in that catalog because we do get a larger size bulb for that catalog, which costs us more.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, and that's, okay. I mean, it's hard to explain. I mean, there are so many different things that go into how you cost products, besides the shipping and handling also, it's very hard to explain it over the radio, but it's marketing, I guess that's what I'd say.
All right, Charlotte, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. Alan in Kenosha is next. Hello, Alan.
Hello, I really enjoy the show. And my questions are, I have some some privet hedges in my front yard.
Okay.
And I fertilized half of them about 2 years ago, actually.
Okay.
And then the other half I didn't. And I'm just wondering, to make the growth in them even, I was thinking of fertilizing them like within the next week or two with a slow-release fertilizer, and I wonder if that would be a good idea. And then I was reading in the Kenosha paper, in the gardening articles, and they were suggesting just to put compost on top of your garden area, dig it in a little bit, but don't till too much. And I was just wondering what the thoughts on that were, if I should just dig in the compost a little bit on the top and pretty much leave it, or
okay with the shrub thing. The privets are not heavy feeders. I mean, they all plants like to have a little bit of fertilization, but you kind of control the way a privet hedge grows by the way you trim it. And you know, if one side is getting too large or one side gets way out of whack with the other, with most hedges, and privet works really well, you take it back to 6 inches from the ground and start it over again, and then you fertilize it and you just prune it so that they're all the same size.
Oh, so I really can't fertilize the other side and hope that they'll just catch up?
I mean, you're talking about one, the north side versus the south side?
No, let's see. I have like a U-shape in my front yard.
Oh, okay.
And
the one size is much larger than the other?
Yeah, because I stopped like halfway through. I know I shouldn't have.
Okay. Yeah, well, the more fertilizer a plant has, the faster and the more it will grow. So if you've got the one side of the is slower growing by fertilizing it more than the other, it will grow faster. So
yeah, so
but if you want to even them out, that's the way to do it. Just take them back to 6 inches and then just prune them so they look the same.
Oh, okay, because they're young plants. They're only like 2 years old.
Okay. Well, then I guess fertilize the one side that needs to grow.
Yeah.
As far as spreading the compost on top of the soil and then just working it in the top, I don't. I use a rototiller once in the springtime when I'm working the soil up, and then I put it away because rototillers tend to break up the soil too much and it'll ruin the soil texture. As far as just adding compost on the top of the soil and just working it in the top few inches, I guess I don't go along with that. I like to make a more homogeneous mixture that the plants are growing in. And when I work up the garden, I spread the compost that I'm going to be putting into the garden on top of it before I work the garden up, and then I work it with the rototiller. Now, I don't work it so that when I'm walking behind the rototiller, my feet sink in 6 inches, because if you're doing that, you're ruining the texture too. You know, I just work it until the soil is rakeable, and then I rake it so that it's level, and then I make my furrows and plant my seeds. If you're working it so when you're walking behind you're sinking in 6 inches, when you get a heavy rain or as the soil kind of compacts down, the soil pores will kind of slam together. And if you don't have a lot of organic matter in the soil, your soil can become as hard as rock.
Mm.
And so then the seeds have a harder time breaking the surface of the soil. So
yeah.
Use a rototiller wisely. You know, it's a great tool to keep the, you know, to get the soil mixed up and to get your garden in good shape, but then put it away and then use a row hoe or use a regular hoe or somehow just after a rain, break up the surface of the soil so it breaks up the capillaries that kind of keep the moisture in the soil and keeps the weeds down.
Yeah, and then that won't, if I do that, then it won't, that'll prevent the cracking in the...
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you'll get more cracking if you work the soil too hard. You also lose texture and, you know, it's just not a good practice to do. I mean, that soil looks beautiful when it's real fluffy and... You know, it's just really easy to make a row, but it ruins the texture of the soil.
Alan, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. Mark from Milwaukee emailed us to say that a rambunctious dog pruned the lower branches on several of their tart and sweet cherry trees, which are about 6 to 8 feet tall. Should we cut the branches off by the trunk, or should we leave them at the existing length? Should we prune now or wait until after bearing fruit?
I would prune right now because the plants are still completely dormant. As far as how far back you'd plant prune them, if the damage is to the branch so that, you know, you're pruning them and they're still going to be part of the broken branch left, I would prune them back to the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just damage on the outside of the tree and the trunk can be saved, that's fine. If you do prune them back to the trunk of the tree, you want to get it as close to the trunk as you can without hurting that little collar that's around the outside, because the collar is what kind of grows around that wound. So you want to prune it so that it's maybe a 16th of an inch higher than that collar, and then that collar just kind of grows right around the branch as the size of the tree increases.
Back to the phones to Bob in De Pere. Hello, Bob. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a vegetable garden, okay. And the soil is there's a lot of clay in the soil around here.
Okay.
And I've been able to grow tomatoes and cucumbers and peas very successfully, but I have no luck with peppers, and I love peppers.
Okay.
And I've tried different varieties of peppers, and what seems to happen every year is I put the peppers in, and they grow, and they get very tall, and they make lots of very dark green leaves, but just tiny little pepper buds appear. And they're on the plant for a while, and then they just fall off.
Okay.
And I think last year I had 9 different pepper plants. Some were the banana peppers and some were bell peppers.
Okay.
And I think out of those 9 plants in the entire summer, I maybe got 2 or 3 peppers all together. And the rest would just, like I say, form little buds and fall off. And I know the first year I put them in years ago, I maybe put too much fertilizer in. But since then, I don't put anything in the soil except that in the spring when I prepare the garden, I always till the soil and I add more good topsoil just to improve the quality. There's a lot of straw that I use to cover the garden over the winter and then even to keep the weeds down in the summer. And so some of that straw I know is decomposing and adding, I hope, to the soil.
Okay.
I might add a little bit of manure, which I buy from a garden store, but I'm not adding lots of liquid or dry nutrient to the soil. So I wouldn't think I'm overfeeding it, but for some reason, peppers just aren't growing in that spot.
Okay, well, first thing I would do is absolutely no fertilizer, because it sounds to me like when plants grow and have beautiful leaves and they're 10 feet tall, that usually means there's too much nitrogen there. So don't fertilize at all in that area.
Okay.
I'd work some organic matter into the soil because that will use up the nitrogen. Maybe some grass clippings, you know, just work those in the area where you're putting the peppers. And the other thing that I would do is when you plant the peppers, because peppers like an acidic soil, they're one of the few vegetables that really thrive in acidic soils. When you're planting your pepper plants, put about a half a dozen unlit matches in the hole with them. And the reason that works is because there's a lot of sulfur in the matches. I mean, when you burn a match, you get sulfur dioxide because that's what you're doing. Put some matches in the hole with the peppers, and that will make the soil quite sour in that area. And hopefully that'll get you some peppers this year.
What a great trick. So in the same hole, just regular unlit paper matches.
Yep, just put you could even rip the book apart and put a whole row of them in with each plant because... And then work that extra organic matter in the soil, too.
Oh, great. Okay, I'll do that. Thank you. I have one other quick question, if I can ask.
What's that?
We have on the corner of our lot a bunch of Rosa rugosa. We used to call them beach roses.
Sure.
And they smell just lovely, and I love them. They're beautiful colors. But after the first year that we had them, they begin to develop some kind of mold, I think. The leaves will turn yellow. Black spots, and eventually the leaves start falling off.
Yeah, it's called black spot.
It's a
disease that bothers all roses. As soon as you see those yellow spots, you have to start spraying with a spray that's meant for black spot. The one that we sell is called Fungin-X.
In fact, I have used that, and I have just hit them over and over and over for, 4 years now, and nothing seems to do it.
Okay, do they have morning sunlight?
It's on the corner of our lot that has the southwest corner.
Okay, because morning sunlight, drying the leaves out, will keep those spores from germinating. Also, with the plants themselves, thin them out so that they're not real thick.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more sunlight that penetrates those plants, what happens is the spores germinate in the dew, and if the germ tube gets into the leaf before the dew dries off, you're going to have disease problems. And so that's why roses need to be in morning sunlight.
I see.
And by thinning the branches out, you get more wind penetration to dry the leaves out.
Right.
And that's why sun in the morning is really important with roses, so that you don't have that disease. The other thing is, be sure you clean all of the leaves that grew out of that plant, because the leaves that are on the ground can be the initial source of infection for the black spot. And then use a dormant spray maybe this spring before the leaves come out and see if that doesn't help.
Okay. That makes sense, because our neighbor has exactly the same roses on the south east corner of his lot, and they're doing fabulously well.
Yeah, Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate hearing from you. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to all of the calls today and all of the emails, but we have run out of time. Dick, thanks very much for coming
you,
in from Randolph and spending some time with us today, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Dick Zondag is president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, celebrating 102 years in business. More information at jungseed.com. Monday at 11, we'll be talking with physical therapist, Associate Professor Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody.